content. Parental discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody. It's 11 o'clock, and thanks for joining us for the 48th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Sorry about that, guys. We're having a bit of a technical issue, and Dr. Mathis is going to call back in. So I'm going to run some music real quick while we get that set back up for you. Hold on just a moment. And Dr. Mathis is back with us. So, Doc, if you're ready again, we'd love to share the music that you have prepared for us tonight. Do you want to give it a second try here?
That's great. Hopefully Skype won't drop me this time.
Yes. Naughty Skype. Bad Skype.
Well, yeah, that was. All right. I was playing very badly.
I will never tell.
All righty. There you go. All right. Well, there you go.
As always, thank you for that and great playing. please let us know the name of the song and the artist and the relevance to tonight's topic.
Sure. So that was Cream's version of the Skip James song, I'm So Glad, which I thought was an appropriate topic for our talk tonight on positivist psychology. So there you have it.
Excellent. As Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled Positive Psychology. But before we begin tonight's topic discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, I've got a couple of cool little trivia snippets for this evening. So the first one I'm going to talk about is a band that everybody knows, but they don't know they know, and they probably don't know some of the most famous folks that were born from that band. So the band I'm talking about are the Yardbirds. And while a lot of people know the songs that they've done, particularly because a lot of them have been redone by folks. So Lost Woman, for example, was redone by the James Gang in their live shows, which they actually did when I saw the James Gang doing a kind of a reunion tour a couple of years ago. They actually played that. So those folks don't always know that was originally a James Gang song. A Yardbird song. The other one that people attribute to Aerosmith, which is The Train Kept Rolling, is also a Yardbird song originally done by Yardbirds that Aerosmith picked up and did. So Heart Full of Soul is the other one that everybody knows. It has the kind of a sitar part in it. So what most people don't know is the Yardbirds kind of had, during their inception, three of probably the most iconic classic rock guitar players ever. Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, yep, and Jimmy Page. So Jimmy Page being the last guitar player of the Yardbirds, who actually owned the rights to the name the Yardbirds. So when the Yardbirds disintegrated, he still had 3 months of gigs to perform and contracts to honor. So he was looking for new people, so he sort of got a new Yardbirds band together, which he called the New Yardbirds, to finish out the last 3 months of their contractual agreements. So he was performing Yardbirds songs with three other guys who weren't the Yardbirds, but in the official original Yardbirds. So once they finished, and while they were doing that, they were working on songs and that sort of thing. So when the band finished its obligations contractually, then they dropped the name of the new Yardbirds and took the name Led Zeppelin. So,
dun, dun,
yeah. Yeah. So Zeppelin came out of Jimmy Page and Yardbirds stuff. So the guys, obviously, he got to replace the Yardbirds people were John Bonham, John Paul Jones, and Robert Plant. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So that's why when you see them putting out their first recording, you know, all the PR says, oh, they were only together for, you know, a couple of weeks before they put this first album out, which is true. They were only together a couple of weeks under that name. But they'd been playing together for 3 months touring and a couple of months prior to that preparing for the tour. So, yeah. It was a little misleading, but of course the public loved it. It's like, oh, they've been together 3 or 4 weeks and now they're putting out a record. Oh my God, that's awesome. You know, but people don't realize that, you know. Yeah, well, and people don't realize that, you know, John Paul Jones was a very, very seasoned studio musician, as was Jimmy Page. So, I mean, John Paul Jones has appeared on a lot of recordings, some of which he didn't get credit for, like a lot of the Donovan stuff. And the same thing with Jimmy Page. So there's a lot of stuff those guys produced, played bass or keyboards or guitar on, that they didn't get credit for, that you never knew about. So when you hear Hurdy Gurdy Man and some of those guys, it's those guys playing on it, you know. So it's a lot of people thinking, oh, it's these new guys came up and the unknown guys, but no, they've been playing studio stuff for a long, long, long time, prior to them getting in bands and then prior to them forming Zeppelin. So they had a pretty good history behind them. So the other piece of trivia I want to talk about is also a band that Clapton played for at one time, and where he got really sort of the majority of his start, and that is with the godfather of British blues, John Mayall. So most people who aren't blues people don't know who John Mayall is, but he was doing blues way before it was GQ and DeBoner. And really is the guy that started the whole British blues thing going. So Clapton was playing for him during a pivotal era in the early to mid-60s. And when he joined John Mayall, it was John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. So when they did their first recording with Clapton, there's the front cover of the picture with Clapton. They're all sitting on the front picture, either standing or sitting, and Clapton's reading a magazine that's got the title Beano on it, and that's why the record's been known as the Beano record. So it's because Clapton's reading a magazine that's got that title on it. And what's even more interesting, or just as interesting about that recording, is that Clapton, prior to this, my understanding is he'd been trying and been largely dissatisfied with a boatload of amplifiers he'd been using live and in the studio for, you know, trying to get stuff to sound right. And when he plugged into this particular model of Marshall, it was just, it nailed the sound that he wanted. And I forget the exact model number of it. And the reason I've forgotten it is because ever since he played on it, it has become so iconic that the Marshall amp has been renamed the Blues Breaker amp because of John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. So that's kind of was Clapton's signature amp for a long time until he got with Cream, and which he was using huge Marshall stacks at that time. But he got, you know, a lot of his notoriety and start really with Mayall and the Yardbirds prior to getting into Cream. So, you know, and the other thing with John Mayall is he started a lot of people or assisted a lot of people's careers, including Papa John Creech, who was a violin player who eventually ended up with Jefferson Starship at one point later in his career. He's also, Jack Bruce of Cream also played with Mayall for a while, and so did Peter Green, who ended up with Fleetwood Mac, and Mick Taylor, who eventually ended up with the Stones, replacing Brian Jones when he drowned in the pool. And, you know, Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac and John McVie of Fleetwood Mac. So all of these guys at one time or another have played with John Mayall. So it's just real interesting. And, of course, Peter Green of Fleetwood Mac fame is the guy that wrote, I think he's the author, if I'm not mistaken, of The Green Manalishi, which was a song later revived by, Judas Priest, you know, and you hear Green Manalishi and you hear that version, you go, oh, Judas Priest song. No, that's a Fleetwood Mac song, right? The other one that everybody knows that people attribute to another artist is Black Magic Woman, which people attribute to Santana. That is a Peter Green song when he was with Fleetwood Mac. So, right, all of these songs that everybody thinks, oh, Fleetwood, Carlos Santana, oh, Judas Priest. No. They did covers of their version of covers of those songs. Santana's version of Black Magic Woman is pretty close to the Peter Green Fleetwood Mac version. It's a little more organ, no pun intended, organized, not organized, but organized, as in B3, with Greg Raleigh playing the organ, of course, who then, of course, later went on to make Journey. I digress. Yeah, same keyboard player. So left he and Neil Schon, who came in later with the Santana Man, left to form Journey. So at any rate, you know, all of that, there's that and the Green Manalishi are both Fleetwood Mac songs. So finally, my little, and all of these unrelated trivias, the other one I wanted to talk about is Bob Dylan. And most people know him as an acoustic and an electric songwriter, singer, and I use the term loosely, no offense, Bob. your music writing talents are a lot more proficient than your vocal skills, no offense, when you compare that to somebody like Greg Lake. And again, I mean no disrespect to Bob Dylan, because obviously he's written a boatload of amazingly good songs. So most folks know him as a musician, artist person, songwriter person. Most people don't know that he also had a small part in the movie Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, which is what made famous Knocking on Heaven's Door, because that was a song he wrote for the movie. Yeah, the song he wrote for the movie, and then they gave him a part in the movie. He's actually pretty good in the movie. He plays kind of a small role, but it's really funny to see him on camera because he's very natural. And I'm actually surprised he didn't do more movie roles because he's really pretty good on this thing. I'm like, well, goddamn, Bob, go. That's awesome. Yeah, part of the reason I bring the Dylan trivia into this is in part to honor Vinnie Paul, who just recently passed. My understanding is of a heart attack, heart conditions. And for those listeners who don't know, Vinnie Paul was the drummer, longtime drummer for Pantera and for Damage Plan and for Hell Yeah. Most of you know his brother, Dimebag Darrell, who was shot to death, which is what effectively ended Pantera. At a show in Columbus, Ohio, at actually one of the clubs I used to go to when I was in Ohio. So it was kind of a shocker, as I've been in that club several times. And it was pretty amazing to hear that at the time. But at any rate, and of course, Darryl was a fabulous guitar player. Whether you like that kind of music or not, yeah, Darryl was he was the bomb. So part of that was to say, you know, my condolences to the family for Vinnie Paul and for those listeners who didn't know, to kind of let them in on what's going on. So anyway, that's my trivia, three pieces of trivia for this evening, and that's the truth.
Thank you, Ruth Buzzy. Alrighty. Again, we will be taking calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. Please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. So tonight's show is called Positive Psychology. There is a continuum of mental health. At the low end is serious and active psychopathology crisis. And at the top end, the most psychologically healthy and adjusted individual you can imagine. Mainstream psychology and pretty much all of psychiatry focuses on the lower end of this continuum, reducing harm from psychopathology and improving function to the point where people can get by in their daily lives. Just like with your physiological health, where you don't merely stop at just not having various common problems such as weight issues, blood pressure, heart, stress, sleep problems, and similar things. You want to also not just be doing good enough and not suffering or causing continuous damage, but actually flourishing in your life. The same principles apply to your mental health, where there is so much focus on the low end of the charts, where people are in clear and ongoing distress. But if you have done your work and are maintaining a decent and stable mental health status, might there be room for more improvement, for actually making one's psychological lives easier and better, and moving up that psychological adjustment continuum? So tonight we will discuss, first, a basic overview of positive psychology. Second, an overview of the origins of positive psychology and a profile of its founder. And third, how these techniques differ from typical psychological and counseling work, and how you can use them in your own lives. So before we get into that and get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you want to add before we get into this.
Yeah, I just wanted to take a brief shout out to let listeners know that while this is a somewhat new, not new, but a fairly new movement, if you will, in psychology in the last probably 10 years, or so. This has kind of been the attitude of a lot of social work profession and some counseling professions for a long time, focusing more on the strengths than the weaknesses. So this is kind of we're sort of a Johnny come lately in the psychology department for this kind of stuff. So.
Fair enough. And that is true. And definitely what's good about this, and we'll talk about that tonight, is that this is not just some feel good stuff that people want to talk about. There's science behind this. And so those who want their psychology to be crunchy, there's stuff in here for you tonight. So with that, let's go ahead and get to the first part, which is a basic overview of positive psychology. First, the definition of positive psychology, and my source for this is the website positivepsychology.org.uk. Positive psychology is a science of positive aspects of human life, such as happiness, well-being, and flourishing. It can be summarized in the words of its founder, Martin Seligman, as the scientific study of optimal human functioning that aims to discover and promote the factors that allow individuals and communities to thrive. Psychology has more often than not emphasized the shortcomings of individuals as compared with their potentials. This particular approach focuses on the potentials. It is not targeted at fixing problems, but is focused on researching things that make life worth living instead. In short, positive psychology is concerned not with how to transform, for example, a negative 8 up to a negative 2, but with how to bring a positive 2 up to a positive 8. This orientation in psychology was established about 10 years ago, and we mean this formally as opposed to there being people in the industry who were already supporting it individually. And it is a rapidly developing field. Its aspiration is to bring solid empirical research into areas such as well-being, flow, personal strengths, wisdom, creativity, psychological health, and characteristics of positive groups and institutions. So according to the website, there are three levels of positive psychology. The science of positive psychology operates on three different levels: the subjective level, the individual level, and the group level. The subjective level includes the study of positive experiences such as joy, well-being, satisfaction, contentment, happiness, optimism, and flow. This level is about feeling good rather than doing good or being a good person. At the next level, the aim is to identify the constituents of the so-called good life and the personal qualities that are necessary for being a, quote, good person. Through studying human strengths and virtues, future-mindedness, capacity for love, courage, perseverance, forgiveness, originality, wisdom, interpersonal skills, and giftedness. Finally, at the group or community level, the emphasis is on civic virtues, social responsibilities, nurturance, altruism, civility, tolerance, work ethics, positive institutions, and other factors that contribute to the development of citizenship and communities. Why is positive psychology important? According to positive psychologists, for most of its life, mainstream psychology, sometimes also referred to as, quote, psychology as usual, has been concerned with the negative aspects of human life. There have been pockets of interest in topics such as creativity, optimism, and wisdom, but these had not been united by any grand theory or a broad overarching framework. This rather negative state of affairs was not the original intention of the first psychologists, but came about through a historical accident. Prior to the Second World War, psychology had three tasks, which were to, first, cure mental illness, second, improve normal lives, and third, identify and nurture high talent. However, after the war, the last two tasks somehow just got lost, leaving the field to concentrate predominantly on the first one. How did that happen? Given that psychology as a science depends heavily on the funding of governmental bodies, it is not hard to guess what happened to the resources after World War II. Understandably, facing a human crisis on such an enormous scale, all available resources were poured into learning about and the treatment of psychological illness and psychopathology. This is how psychology as a field learned to operate within a disease model. This model has proven very useful. Martin Seligman highlights the victories of the disease model, which are, for example, the 14 different previously incurable mental illnesses such as depression, personality disorders, or anxiety attacks can now successfully be treated. However, the costs of adopting this disease model included the negative view of psychologists as, quote, victimologists and pathologizers. I am having trouble saying this word. I'm sorry. It's pathologizers. The failure to address the improvement of normal lives and the identification and nurturance of high talent. Just to illustrate, if you were to say to your friends that you were going to go see a psychologist, what is the most likely response that you would get? What's wrong with you? How likely are you to hear something along the lines of, great, are you planning to concentrate on self-improvement? The Western world has long overgrown the rationale for an exclusively disease model of psychology. Perhaps now is the time to readdress the balance by using psychology resources to learn about, quote, normal and flourishing lives, rather than lives that are in need of help. Perhaps now is the time to gather knowledge about strengths and talents, high achievement in every sense of the word, the best ways and means of self-improvement, fulfilling work and relationships, and a great art of ordinary living carried out in every corner of the planet. This is the rationale behind the creation of positive psychology. However, positive psychology is still nothing else but psychology, adopting the same scientific method. It simply studies different and often far more interesting, that's an opinion, topics and asks slightly different questions, such as what works rather than what doesn't, or what is right with this person rather than what is wrong. We'll check in with you at this point, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything you want to add before we continue.
Yeah, two things. First of all, that's part of the reason that this new field, well, new as of the last, you know, 8 or 10 years, this coaching field has come up, because coaching is much more based on a positive model than there's a negative, and I see that as trying to fill the gap that psychology has kind of like lost for a while. Excuse me. The other thing that I find interesting is that Martin Seligman's work started with a phenomenon called learned helplessness, in which he discovered to try to explain some of the reasons why victims kind of give up, or folks give up after they've had trauma or whatever, excuse me, through an experiment he did with dogs and shocking their cages and allowing them to jump into another cage that wasn't electrified, and then he electrified the other cage, so no matter which one of the cages they jumped into, they got shocked. They just kind of sat there and whimpered and got shocked. And he made a lot of correlates between that and human behavior once the human decides that nothing I can do is going to change anything, which may or may not really be true, but if they feel that way, they're just going to kind of give up and do this learned helplessness kind of thing. So it's interesting to me that he developed the positivist psychology out of his experience with learned helplessness.
Yes, and actually, when we get into his biography, we're going to talk about the details of that a little bit more, because there's a verified relationship, and then there's kind of a leap of logic that I've taken where I think they all connect together.
Cool.
So, okay. So let's go ahead and go to the second part, which is an overview of the origins of positive psychology and a profile of its founder. So the first part is the history of positive psychology. So Dr. Seligman worked with Christopher Peterson to create what they describe as a positive counterpart to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, what we refer to as the DSM. While the DSM focuses on what can go wrong, their book, Character Strengths and Virtues, published in 2004, is designed to look at what can go right. In their research, they looked across cultures and across millennia to attempt to distill a manageable list of virtues that have been highly valued from ancient China and India through Greece and Rome up into contemporary Western cultures. Their list included 6 character strengths: wisdom or knowledge, courage, humanity, justice, temperance, and transcendence. Each of these has 3 to 5 sub-entries. For instance, temperance includes under that umbrella forgiveness, humility, prudence, and self-regulation. The authors do not believe that there is a hierarchy for the six virtues. No one is more fundamental than or a precursor to the others. Next is a biography of Dr. Marty Seligman. Martin E.P. Marty Seligman, Ph.D., is the director of the Penn Positive Psychology Center. He is the Zellerbach Family Professor of Psychology in the Penn Department of Psychology, and he is the director of the Penn Master of Applied Positive Psychology Program, which is called MAPP, M-A-P-P. He is an American psychologist, educator, and author of self-help books. Dr. Seligman was born in Albany, New York, and received his BA from Princeton, summa cum laude, in philosophy in 64. PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in psychology in 67. PhD honoris causa from Uppsala University in Sweden in 89. Doctor of Humane Letters honoris causa, Massachusetts College of Professional Psychology in 97. PhD honoris causa, Complutense University in Spain, 2003, and PhD honoris causa, University of East London, 2006. So he has quite a bit of wallpaper. Commonly known as the founder of positive psychology, Martin Seligman is a leading authority in the fields of positive psychology, resilience, learned helplessness, as we talked about earlier, and we will again, depression, optimism, and pessimism. He is also a recognized authority on interventions that prevent depression and build strengths and well-being. He has written more than 250 scholarly publications and 20 books. Dr. Seligman's books have been translated into more than 20 languages and have been bestsellers both in America and abroad. Among his better-known works are Flourish, Authentic Happiness, Learned Optimism, The Optimistic Child, Helplessness, and Abnormal Psychology. His book, Character Strengths and Virtues, A Handbook and Classification, was co-authored with Christopher Peterson. In 1998, Dr. Seligman was elected president of the American Psychological Association, or the APA. His primary aim as APA president was to join practice and science together so both may flourish, a goal that has dominated his own life as a psychologist. Since 2000, his main mission has been the promotion of the field of positive psychology. Dr. Seligman is expanding positive psychology to education, health, and neuroscience, and has applied his research to groups like teachers and students, the U.S. Army, athletes, and everyday people. He was inspired by Aaron Beck, who is a renowned psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania and the father of cognitive therapy. Other work of Dr. Seligman's, which is the Learned Helplessness and Depression. And we wanted to showcase this additional work of Dr. Seligman's because it is relevant to depression and loosely relevant for our next show, which is going to be a follow-up on suicide. Seligman's foundational experiments and theory of learned helplessness began at University of Pennsylvania in 67 as an extension of his interest in depression. Quite by accident, Seligman and colleagues discovered that the experimental conditioning protocol that they used with dogs led to behaviors which were unexpected, in that under the experimental conditions, the recently conditioned dogs did not respond to opportunities to learn to an escape from an unpleasant situation. Seligman developed the theory further, finding learned helplessness to be a psychological condition in which a human being or an animal has learned to act or behave helplessly in a particular situation, usually after experiencing some inability to avoid an adverse situation, even when it actually has the power to change its unpleasant or even harmful circumstance. Seligman saw a similarity with severely depressed patients and argued that clinical depression and related mental illnesses result in part from a perceived absence of control over the outcome of a situation. In later years, alongside Abramson, Seligman reformulated his theory of learned helplessness to include attributional style. Attributional style emerged from research on depression with Abramson, Seligman, and Teasdale in 78, arguing that a characteristic way of attributing negative outcomes to internal, stable, and global causes would be associated with depression in response to negative events happening to them. Learned helplessness theory is the view that clinical depression and related mental illnesses may result from such real or perceived absence of control over the outcome of a situation. Next part I want to talk about is the enhanced interrogation controversy. James Elmer Mitchell, who was an Air Force psychologist who worked for the CIA, was involved in the development of enhanced interrogation techniques. Mitchell attended a meeting at Seligman's home regarding the September 11 attacks and the psychology of capitulation in December of 2001. Mitchell also attended a three-hour talk from Seligman, sponsored by the Joint Personnel Recovery Agency, JPRA, on learned helplessness and torture resistance at Naval Base San Diego in May 2002. The Senate Intelligence Committee report on CIA torture stated that the enhanced interrogation techniques were based on the theory of learned helplessness. Seligman has stated that his involvement does not extend beyond those two events. He does not support torture and is grieved and horrified that good science may have been used for such a bad and dubious purpose as torture. Parenthetically, it is my personal contention that resentment of this incident may have driven Seligman's next work to be full-on dedicated to positivity. I did not find proof of this, but given his history, it seems likely, because all this went down in the early 2000s, and then his book came out in 2004. Before we go to the next part, I'm going to check in with Dr. Mathis and see if there's anything that you'd like to add.
I'm good.
Okie dokie. So the next part is how these techniques differ from typical psychological and counseling work and how you can use them in your own lives. And a source for a lot of this is Wikipedia, with other sources in between. Character Strengths and Virtues, CSV, is a book by Christopher Peterson and Martin Seligman in 2004 that attempts to present a measure of humanist ideals of virtue in an empirical, rigorously scientific manner. In the same way that the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, is used to assess and facilitate research on mental disorders, CSV is intended to provide a theoretical framework to assist in developing practical applications for positive psychology. CSV identifies six classes of virtue, i.e., quote, core virtues, made up of 24 measurable, quote, character strengths. The organization of the six virtues and 24 strengths is as follows. First is wisdom and knowledge as the virtue, and its strengths are creativity, curiosity, open-mindedness, love of learning, perspective, and innovation. The second is courage, and under that is bravery, persistence, integrity, vitality, and zest. The third is humanity, under which is love, kindness, and social intelligence. The fourth is justice, under which is citizenship, fairness, and leadership. The fifth is temperance, under which is forgiveness and mercy, humility, prudence, and self-control. And the last is transcendence, appreciation of beauty and excellence, gratitude, hope, humor, and spirituality. The virtues presented to some extent mirror the cardinal virtues and theological virtues of Aristotle and Aquinas, which are hope, faith, charity, prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance in their respective parts. CSV defined character strengths as satisfying most of the 10 following criteria. Character strengths are fulfilling, intrinsically valuable in an ethical sense. Parenthetically, gifts, skills, aptitudes, and expertise can be squandered, but character strengths and virtues cannot. Non-rivalrous, not the opposite of a desirable trait. A counterexample is steadfast and flexible, which are opposites, but are both commonly seen as desirable. Trait-like, parenthetically, habitual patterns that are relatively stable over time. Not a combination of the other character strengths in the CSV. Personified, at least in the popular imagination, by people made famous through story, song, etc. Observable in child prodigies, though this criterion is not applicable to all character strengths. Absent in some individuals, and nurtured by societal norms and institutions. The introduction of CSV suggests that these six virtues are considered good by the vast majority of cultures and throughout history, and that these traits lead to increased happiness when practiced. Notwithstanding numerous cautions and caveats, this suggestion of universality hints that in addition to trying to broaden the scope of psychological research to include mental wellness, the leaders of the positive psychology movement are challenging moral relativism and suggesting that virtue has a biological basis. These arguments are in line with the science of morality. Each of the 24 character traits is defined behaviorally, with psychometric evidence demonstrating that it can be reliably measured. The book shows that empirically minded humanists can measure character strengths and virtues in a rigorous scientific manner. Practical applications of positive psychology include helping individuals and organizations correctly identify their strengths and use them to increase and sustain their respective levels of well-being. Each trait provides one of many alternative paths to virtue and well-being. Therapists, counselors, coaches, and various other psychological professionals can use the new methods and techniques to build and broaden the lives of individuals who are not necessarily suffering from mental illness or disorder. Since Dr. Seligman is still actively teaching and researching, the best way for our listeners to get involved in positive psychology is to check out his Gateway page at the University of Pennsylvania, which is www.authentichappiness.sas.upenn.edu. There are books for sale, college courses you can take, workshops, studies, and experiments for which one can volunteer if local to the campus, and many more updates on his work. One might also consult your own trusted mental health professional about incorporating some of this methodology into your own therapy. And with this, I will check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you want to add.
Yeah, one of the reasons that I do all the testing with folks, excuse me, is not just to discern what they're weak in, but also to discern what they're strong in, so that I can use those strengths and the things that are quote-unquote average, normal, whatever you want to call it, in to help remediate the stuff that isn't so great. So while I look at, excuse me, all of the what I call OBF, organic brain farts, that people have, yeah, I also look at all the positive stuff and the strengths that folks have as a way to help repair or to get around the parts of their brain that aren't working as well. And that's part of also what the testing reveals to me, which is obviously very useful in what I do, because if all you do is give people bad news, it's pretty clear that they get, you know, very disenchanted and disheartened pretty quickly, and you can't really blame them. So, you know, part of what you're trying to do is instill some expectation that they can overcome the stuff that's going on with them by some of the by virtue of some of the strengths that they have. The other thing that I try to do is to look at where they are in life, and if they have successes, which most people have some level of success in some area of their existence, excuse me, is to use those areas as evidence that they have, you know, character traits and strengths in, you know, character trait ABC or in skill set ABC or whatever, as kind of a reminder and empirical evidence that they have been able to compensate at some level, and in some cases a lot of levels, despite whatever stuff's going on with them. Because I think a lot of people take some of the successes for granted, particularly if they tend to have lower self-esteem or lower self-efficacy or be kind of depressed or they're anxious and they're focused on their issues. as opposed to the stuff that they're doing well, and they tend to minimize that kind of stuff. So that's part of, I see that as part of my job, is trying to bring that into their awareness so that they can use that as a strength to hook on to as they're remediating their weakness stuff.
Fair enough. Okay, so this more or less concludes our show on positive psychology. We hope our listeners have a better understanding about the fact that mental health is not all just about damage control, and that those who are doing well in their adjustments have plenty of room to further flourish in life. And is there anything else that you want to add from earlier parts of the show, or anything else in wrap-up that you want to put in here?
Yeah, one thing I would say is I have a couple of folks that are seeing me for what I would call growth enhancement. And they're not just coming in for problems, they're coming in for growth enhancement stuff. Or some of the one folk that's been seeing me for a really, really long period of time, like 14 years, almost 15.
Wow.
Started out, yeah, started out with some, you know, clear deficits and parts that weren't working that well for this individual, who, after this person got a handle on that, started looking at other areas to improve on in life and said, well, hey, let's look at this. And let's, because the success this person experienced overcoming some of the deficits that this person had then sort of gave this person like, hey, maybe I can do this and this and this too. And so what's grown into, hey, let me look at this stuff. Let me look at improving over here. Let me look at, you know, this isn't that great. I want to make improvement. This, you know, I want to change what I do here, has really morphed into this individual becoming very existentially aware. And I call this person, you know, one of my few, very few full growth mode persons who continues to come see me. Despite the fact that from a pathological perspective, this person doesn't quote-unquote need to see me and hasn't for a long period of time. And I found myself early on when this individual was coming in for growth enhancement stuff, I kept apologizing and saying to this person, hey, you don't really quote-unquote need me. You know that there's nothing really kind of going on here with this and that and the other. And this person goes, oh, my God, let me tell you what I got to improve on, you know. And I'm like, don't even go there. If you want to see people that have stuff to improve on, turn yourself into a fly and come fly into my office about 7 o'clock tonight. I'll show you improvement areas that need to be improved, right? And, of course, the person just starts laughing. But it's really true. I mean, this individual is in total growth mode and comes in all kind of preparedness to bring in stuff to discuss, and sometimes artwork, sometimes poetry, sometimes writing, talking about trying to connect issues to growth stuff in an existential sort of way. And it's really cool working with someone such as this individual. But in the early stages, it was a little disquieting for the therapist, for me, because I'm so used to putting fires out and teaching people how to grow beyond fires. And then usually when they get the fire under control and they kind of have some level of mastery in that one area, they're like, okay, thanks a lot. That was great. See you later. And that's fine. I'm good with that. But that's what I'm used to. And so when I have a couple of people who, you know, find value in personal growth and really enhancing their lives like crazy, on one hand, I'm shocked. And on the other hand, it's like, wow, that's really cool, because that makes my work a whole lot more fun. You know, so my head is off to this individual, and I say that to this person almost every week when I see this person. But it's just really, it's really cool to see that. I don't get that opportunity very often, and so I always like it when people transcend their stuff and get into growth mode, and then they're all like, "Yeah, this is this is fun," because I see positive avenues in my life. I'm not just like trying to put fires out and remediate, you know, bad stuff. I'm actually growing and, you know, my life is enhanced, and I'm enjoying things more, and I'm getting into stuff I would never get into, and I'm having the courage and, you know, whatever to try stuff. And I just think that's like awesome. I just love seeing that. I just don't see it as much as I'd like to. So,
yeah,
there you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really
no,
cool.
I absolutely understand that. And that's kind of part of what we're talking about tonight. You know, just like with your physical stuff, let's say you got your blood sugar under control and your blood pressure's doing good and you're eating better and all this stuff, and that's not all there is to it. And so when you get to that point, you kind of need somewhere new to go, and your mental health kind of works in a similar way. So.
Right. And what's been interesting with this individual is this individual's had some physical things along the way that this individual and I both tied as his body's symbolic representation of what he was doing to himself, which I felt was very interesting. And when the person had that sort of aha moment, sort of coincidentally, you know, by coincidence, this person's physical condition halted and is actually getting a little bit better, when this is a condition that usually deteriorates over time and causes significant life limitations. And this person's not experiencing that because this person's taken their physical health into their own. They're changing dietary stuff and doing very physical healthy, but they're also not beating the crap out of themselves. So when people don't beat the crap out of themselves, if they develop an autoimmune disorder, for example, you know, what are autoimmune disorders? They're the body attacking them, itself. So if you have a person who's used to beating the crap out of themselves all their lives, and then they develop an autoimmune disorder, when it doesn't run in their family, there's no history of it, yada, 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 you're like, I'm wondering if this is the physical manifestation of his existential lifelong stance.
Yeah.
And so once that gets addressed, and we're minimizing beating the shit out of ourselves all the time, and I can't say anything about that because I'm fabulous at doing that to myself too. So, you know, this is not the pot calling the kettle black. Let me tell you, the pot is very black. Okay, just saying. This individual has really taken the bull by the horn, so to speak, and has halted this person's physical condition that folks consider to be, I don't want to say impossible, but almost unheard of. And this person has put a halt to the progression of this particular physical disability, illness, whatever you want to call it, and is actually doing things that the physician said this person will not be able to do. So I just think that's just fabulous. And I share that with the listeners just to say that, you know, don't ever say never, and don't ever say impossible, and don't ever let anybody limit you in anything you do. And, you know, you've heard me say this before, and yes, I'm going to say it again. Take your flipping power back, because this person has definitely done that and then some.
Definitely.
So there you have it. There you have it. Oh, I love it. It's the bomb. I love it.
Yeah, no, I definitely can vouch for that in my own life. You know, there's been a lot of things that I've been struggling with. And interestingly, in the last few months, a lot of physiological things that I have been dealing with they're just improving. I actually don't even know why, because I've been fighting these fights for a long time, but all of a sudden something's moving and I'll take it, you know. And it's true. Once you get those tools back and you start to heal, then you've got some, you know, proverbial extra spoons for stuff, and it's like, okay, I actually have the energy to do something now. Let's go improve this. It's the first thing you reach for. Is let's keep going, because this is awesome.
Yeah, it becomes more of a fun chore than, oh, geez, I got to do this.
Yeah. And you have, you know, something cool to look forward to.
Awesome.
Because it's going well. Yes, yes.
Absolutely.
Today I went and got my eyes examined, and I actually totally passed my eye test, which, you know, I'm old and stuff, so I have a little bit of stuff going on, but I'm doing really, really well. And like a few other tests I'd done recently, I'm doing amazingly a lot better than I thought I was, which is so strange. I don't know if I've been kidnapped by aliens and healed and I forgot, or I don't know. But you know, now
you
feel like
really
going
funny.
And doing more stuff.
Well, I'll tell you what's really funny. The last time I had my eyes checked, because I was starting to get blurry vision, I thought, well, here we go, another increase in my vision, because my vision sucks. And I go in there, and the guy goes, oh, yeah, you're going to need glasses that are, you know, a couple of things lighter. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, your vision's improved. What? Yeah,
nope.
Your vision's actually gotten better. And I'm like, what the hell? Because, I mean, it has done nothing but, like, tank since I was 11 or 12. So it's like, well, you know, that would not offend me if, as I got older, my vision got better, you know. But it was really a shock to me. I'm like, well, hell, goddamn, this has been a lifelong condition. Maybe I can do some other shit, too. So this was like a little wimpy thing. But it was like, hey, you know, and so I totally hear you. So the person about whom I was speaking must be, I can only imagine how like ecstatic this person is at what this person's doing, and kudos to this individual, because this person has done all the work, and you know, all the credit goes to this individual, not to me. I'm just a teacher. That's it. Bottom line.
Yep. Yeah. That's fair. Yep.
Yes, ma'am.
So, okay. So on behalf of myself and Dr. Mathis and NDB Media, thank you to our listeners this evening, and appreciation also to those of you who will be joining us later via podcast or iTunes or what have you. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks on Wednesday, July 11th at 11 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for our new topic brought to you right here on blogtalkradio.com. So keep an eye out for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on.